This revealing book will appeal to many readers, including people who may never have read about Jonathan Edwards, may never even have heard his name. Marriage to a Difficult Man is a tempting blend of family guidance book, sociological study, psychologically and devotionally oriented American historical biography, as easy to read for relaxation as for information. Mrs. Dodds stresses a side of Edwards, the stern ascetic, not generally known, the lover and the father, a man whose children seemed genuinely to love him, clear pictures of Sarah Pierpont, his spirited wife, their love, and every one of their 10 children emerge in the anecdotal telling of the Edwards's fascinating story. In addition to showing what Sarah and Jonathan were both really like, Mrs. Dodds asks, what did they do to help their children turn out so well? For this famous colonial American theologian and his wife produced by their remarkable marriage a line of descendants who probably contributed more constructive leadership to American society than any other family of their century. What they did, as Mrs. Dodds tells it, could well be a pattern for modern parents, could help them administer a potent but potable blend of permissiveness and discipline that would result in just the kind of mature handling of problems every parent hopes his children will have. A fringe benefit I did not foresee 10 years ago when I began my long research, continues Mrs. Dodds, is its possible comfort for people in our current economic recession. Edwards's family shared their father's famous dismissal from his parish, the ensuing year of unemployment, the humiliating demotion to an assignment which must have appeared to them and others who knew him as a ludicrous misuse of his genius. The rigors they endured then are the same many families are experiencing now, and the example of the dignity and magnanimity with which the Edwardses met their test could well fortify others. This book is recorded by permission of the Westminster John Knox Press. Marriage to a Difficult Man, The Uncommon Union of Jonathan and Sarah Edwards, by Elizabeth D. Dodds. Preface. For 10 years I have contended with this material, tried to elude it. Why try to share with our jittery generation a love story from green, smogless, colonial New England? What could be more archaic than a report of a faithful marriage and the useful children it produced? But now I feel that there is a point in precisely the anachronism which troubled me, in the contrast between today's casual devaluation of sex and the focused ardor of the Edwardses, between their approach to child raising and the current skepticism about the family, between today's God, merely one of the milder swear words, and Edwards's God, the central fact. Yes, we are far removed in time and psychological orientation from this pair, but I think their story holds a healing ingredient. This is no attempt to retread the many biographies of Edwards. Since I am not a professional scholar, that would be impertinent as well as redundant. Instead, I have stressed a side of Edwards that is not generally known. The mythic picture of him is of the stern theologian. He was, in fact, a tender lover and a father whose children seemed genuinely fond of him. To probe this marriage, however, is to discover that this was not just a radiant ideal. Here were two exceedingly complex people. An indication of the labyrinthine character of Edwards can be seen in the fact that the major poet, Robert Lowell, tried to write a book about him and quit, defeated by the subject. To dip beneath the surface saintliness of Edwards's wife is to enter a dark maze of questions. What are the real motivations for self-giving? Is the impulse to sainthood, in truth, neurotic? At first fascinated by this woman's holiness, I became equally interested that she had not come to it easily. In the middle of her life, she briefly entered a period of such confusion that it could be called psychotic. Yet all contemporary reports of her, as well as her mark upon the personalities of her children, indicate that she emerged from this episode with a reformed personality, which survived severe external pressures later. She went on carrying the same heavy load, but carried it as an expression of joy, not of compulsion. Friends unanimously report that she was one of the rare life-enhancing individuals, ones who make others feel more alive. Moving within the constricting demands of the everyday, she richly responded to the claims of children, friends, tempestuous husband. How did she do it? Or here do we confront the mystery of grace? A biographer treads a spongy swamp. To tell a straightforward story full of footnotes leaves unanswered many questions about this intricate relationship. Yet to make a novel of it would be preposterous, an offense to the scrupulously truthful Edwards. How can one stay historically respectable, yet read behind the external evidence? How can one ask whether this woman really adored her husband, or whether she was clawed by conflicting feelings about him? Did she welcome all those pregnancies? Is it possible to recapture the real thoughts of remote persons? All we know about Sarah Edwards is refracted from others. Writing letters was not one of her abilities, and she was too busy to keep a journal. So I have needed occasionally to whittle a new piece to fit a hole in the puzzle. Out of such fragments as we have, one can shape a case history, as an anthropologist can take a few fragments of bone and link them upon the armature of his imagination to reconstruct a creature he has never seen. My product would be, I hope, a parable for the befuddled woman in any period of history. The buried talons, the unfruitful fig tree, the virgin's lamps. These two were parables out of even remoter time, even stranger cultures. Yet ancient parables can illuminate the contemporary. A minor explanation. There is an old muddle about the spelling of Sarah's maiden name, Pierpont. In the sources is more on this. Here, as in many ways, I defer to Perry Miller, the estimable Edwards scholar. That this project has been finished is testimony to the fortifying patience of David H. Scott. My own family confirm my conviction that home is still where the heart of civilization is, as it was in the 18th century. E.D.D. Chapter 1. Jonathan Edwards Meets His Match. Someday, after mastering the winds, the waves, the tides, and gravity, we shall harness for God the energies of love, and then, for the second time in history, man will have discovered fire. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. In 1723 in New Haven, Connecticut, when Yale was a chaotic young college, an improbable couple met. Shy Jonathan Edwards was so bright that he had already graduated and worked nearly a year in New York and was still only 20 years old. Sarah Pierpont was a flighty sprite of 13. Edwards pursued her solemnly for 4 years. Then they were married, and their real romance began. With Sarah, the lonely Edwards was rooted and grounded in love. She provided him with an orderly routine that hedged him against distractions and left him free to write his books. Her character became his proof that the distant god of his speculations was also a tender personal god who moves about in the midst of human affairs. In the last moment of Edwards' life, he did not speak about theology. He spoke of Sarah and their uncommon union. But it is remarkable that these two survived their courtship. Moody, socially bumbling, barricaded behind the stateliness of the very shy, Edwards was totally unlike the girl who fatefully caught his eye. She was a vibrant brunette with erect posture and burnished manners. She was skillful at small talk. He had no talent for it at all. She was blithe, he given to black patches of introspection. Yale was full of other young men who could crack a casual joke or swoop up gracefully on ice skates to invite Sarah to glide around a pond with them. Edwards was the kind of gawky boy whose ankles would have wobbled. When he first showed an interest in Sarah, he scared her. Already it was clear that this glowering young man was touched by the fatal ingredient of greatness. Though one of the youngest members of his class, he had entered college at the age of 13. He had been the valedictory orator in 1720. Back now to work as a tutor and pursue a graduate degree, he was collecting a reputation as a formidable intellect. Physically, too, he was marked by an odd sort of majesty. Men in the 18th century were short, but Edwards, 6 feet and then some, towered over his contemporaries. He had unusually piercing, luminous eyes. Even his eating habits made him different from other people. That was an era of jolly gorging. Fish, game, and poultry abounded. Gingerbread, hot muffins, jam, home-produced honey covered every table. But Edwards pecked at a plate and admonished himself in his journal in September 1723. By sparingness in diet and eating as much as may be what is light and easy of digestion, I shall doubtless be able to think more clearly and shall gain time, 1, by lengthening out my life, 2, shall need less time for digestion after meals, 3, shall be able to study more closely. Edwards also was different because he was not a drinker. Puritans consumed hard liquor in astonishing quantities. Edwards's own father turned out a locally famed hard cider in the orchard behind his house. One Massachusetts town of 40 families managed in 1721 to tuck away 3,000 barrels of hard cider. But Edwards would lurk in a corner for a whole evening, fiddling with a single glass while the punch bowl emptied and refilled, and other young men around him grew flushed, slapped backs, told gamey jokes. Few people knew Edwards well enough to jab him genially in the ribs. Often people who turn out to be the most interesting adults are the ones least acceptable to their adolescent peers. This is painful at the age when popularity is the measure of a person's sense of self-worth. The greatest discomfort for an adolescent is to jut out from a crowd, and Edwards was painfully conspicuous. At first, when Edwards lingered at the doorstep of the church, hoping to speak to the preacher's daughter, he did not realize she was trying to avoid him, for Sarah had been exquisitely trained in courtesy. She had been raised a Pierrepont. Today, status is slippery and many scramble for it, but the Pierreponts never thought about status. That they were serenely supreme is indicated by the ranking of Sarah's brother in his Yale class. Midway in the freshman year, the names of the newest class were posted in the Buttery snack bar. The list ranked boys by social standing, and a boy was stuck with that rating for 4 years. Harvard had the same cruel custom, but there the rating was half on the basis of academic promise. At Yale, where the rating was entirely social, Sarah's brother led his list. Their father, James Pierrepont, was for 30 years minister of the church in New Haven at a time when clergy dominated the political life of the colonies. James Pierrepont is said to have made the motion that Yale be founded, and his was the leading voice in the Saybrook Synod, a gathering in 1708 which fixed church polity, and hence the political and social order of New England for half a century. Pierrepont was a Harvard graduate who had married the granddaughter of John Davenport, a forceful man who was New Haven's first minister. She caught a fatal cold early in her marriage, and Pierrepont's second wife also lived only a short time. Then he made a brilliant third marriage to Mary Hooker, who was to be the mother of Sarah. Mary came of even more lustrous lineage than James did. One of her grandfathers was Thomas Willett, first mayor of New York City. Her other grandfather was Thomas Hooker, a personality so commanding that even Cotton Mather said of him that he could put a king in his pocket. In 1636, Hooker had found the Massachusetts Bay Colony cramped. He said it was like a hive overcrowded with bees, so he led his Cambridge congregation away. They followed Indian trails to a fertile bend in the Connecticut River at the place where Hartford, Connecticut now stands. There these jaunty settlers organized two towns, chose delegates to a general court, and drew up a set of laws that they managed to avoid sending back to England for approval by the king, as other colonies had to do. Under Hooker's exhilarating leadership, the state of Connecticut began in a mood of confidence. It was the first sign of the independence that led to the Revolutionary War. Thomas Hooker's traits of charm, practicality, and tact all reappeared in his great-granddaughter, Sarah. She was raised in a house that had been built for her father by his congregation in 1686 on the corner of Elm and Temple Streets. It was the first of a line of dwellings that New Haveners came to call Quality Row. These houses, enclosing a common green where cattle grazed, were of a straightforward design, shaped in part by the demands of harsh weather, in part by the taste of carpenters and the materials available to them. These men built supremely well, both from internal standards of workmanship and also because everyone in town knew who had worked on what job. As a result, the artless carpenters of colonial New England produced an architecture of restrained elegance and unmatched pleasantness. While they were building Sarah's house, one of the parishioners, a modest farmer named William Cooper, wanted to make a contribution. He had little else to donate, so he dug up two elm saplings and installed the tiny trees on the lawn of the new house. Some other church members thought the trees should have been mulberry, so the minister could raise his own silkworms. Their reaction is yet another evidence that whatever is done in any church will be disapproved by someone. But the trees thrived and were the first of the noble elms, for which New Haven calls itself the Elm City. While Sarah was growing up, New Haven was a pretty town with four public buildings, a meeting house, a jail, a guardhouse, a grammar school, all clustered about a common pasture. Its busy harbor was so shallow that ships rested on the bottom at low tide in order to lure an iron foundry to the village and save the cost of importing tools. The townspeople had donated 140 days of free labor to build the foundry, and stockholders were spared taxes on their investment in it. The town bustled with prosperity. There was no further need to be alert for Indian raids, and the grinding work of clearing stumps and rocks from fields was over. Each house had a garden, and in the evening the cows came home from the common pasture to be milked in their own barns. It was a period of repose after toil and danger. One Puritan preacher described it as a summer season. So it was a happy time to be young, and Sarah's family had given her a comfortable childhood. In addition to his salary, James Pierpont had income from land and from inheritances. When the outlying common fields around New Haven had been distributed among the town people, Pierpont acquired a salt marsh, as well as 150 acres upland east side of East River near Mr. Yale's farm, also 12 acres bog meadow adjoining. So there was a margin of money for extra comforts in the Pierpont house. James even had a luxury few ministers have today, two new silk crepe pulpit gowns in 1 6-year period. Though Puritans looked dourly upon the education of women, whose minds were reputedly weaker than a man's, Sarah had the best training a girl was allowed to have then. In 1711, James ordered a horn book, a small board with a handle, which a child could hold while reading the Lord's Prayer on one side, on the other the alphabet. But Sarah's education, and that of Jonathan's sisters, went considerably beyond this crude tool. These girls came from exceptional families, and they were tutored at home by ambitious, cultivated parents. However, Sarah always was a shaky speller. This and a vagueness about arithmetic seems to have been a characteristic of even privileged girls then. A New Haven girl of similar background had such difficulties that after she had been married 10 years, her brother was still twitting her, "I suppose sister is still learning the multiplication table. I would not have her discouraged. She will get through it by the time she is 50 or 60. Of course, Sarah learned to sew, knit, do patchwork, and recite the catechism. Young ladies of quality were also expected to play a musical instrument. Sarah learned the lute, and later Edwards was often to tuck into his pocket a reminder to buy a new lute string on his travels. No girl in those days was allowed to slouch. She was made to practice good posture by walking with a book on her head for many tedious hours. By the time Sarah became the uneasy object of Edward's awkward advances, she stood instinctively with lifted chin. Though only one portrait of her remains, Sarah is mirrored clearly in the reports of people who met her. Some persons leave contradictory impressions, so the comments about them vary. The observations of those who knew Sarah Pierpont have complete consistency. Everyone mentions her beauty and her way of putting people at ease. Samuel Hopkins, a friend who has left the earliest memoir of the Edwards family, stressed her peculiar loveliness of expression, the combined result of goodness and intelligence. Once Edwards saw her, he was stunned. He took to walking past her house at night for a glimpse of a candle flickering behind an upstairs shutter. When a boat came into Long Wharf with a cargo from England, he would manage to be around as it was unloaded. Almost every ship from England brought a box for the Pierpont, and there was a chance that James would bring a daughter down with him as he checked his orders for mace, allspice, white sugar, saffron, and mirrors for the ladies of his household. Edwards even tried to improve his social dexterity and admonished himself, "Have lately erred in not allowing time enough for conversation." At the close of the school term, he went home to East Windsor, Connecticut, a town that had originally been named Podunk, the Indian word for cornfield. There he was supposed to prepare for his Master of Arts degree. He had work to do, for he had to write an original paper on logic, natural philosophy, or metaphysics, and also to compose some theory in theology that he was scheduled to defend in debate with the faculty. Edwards was a compulsive student, but he paced the room, sharpened his quill pen, and then resharpened it, gazed out of the window, and finally in the front page of a Greek grammar book, he wrote this famous description. "They say there is a young lady in New Haven who is beloved of that great being who made and rules the world, and that there are certain seasons in which this great being, in some way or another invisible, comes to her and fills her mind with exceeding sweet delight, and that she hardly cares for anything except to meditate on him. Therefore, if you present all the world before her with the richest of its treasures, she disregards it and cares not for it and is unmindful of any pain or affliction. She has a strange sweetness in her mind and singular purity in her affections, is most just and conscientious in all her conduct, and you could not persuade her to do anything wrong or sinful if you would give her all the world. She is of a wonderful sweetness, calmness, and universal benevolence of mind. She will sometimes go about from place to place singing sweetly, and seems to be always full of joy and pleasure, and no one knows for what. She loves to be alone, walking in the fields and groves, and seems to have someone invisible always conversing with her." But the object of this digression from Greek grammar, sensed that life with a man like Edwards would be larger than life size. There were other men about of sunnier temperament and blander talents. So Sarah gave Edwards 3 hard years. Chapter 2, A Checkered Courtship. The man whose heart is endeared to the woman he loves, he dreams of her in the night, hath her in his eye and apprehension when he awakes, museth on her as he sits at table. Thomas Hooker. Some qualities that make an admirable husband make a dismal beau. Edwards's massive loyalty was a sterling attribute in a spouse, but it made him a trying swain. It was characteristic of him to pick out one girl to adore, for he hadn't the talent for skating over the surface of many casual relationships, flirting with many girls. So he would watch Sarah with a circle of young people, and then when he finally had a chance to talk to her, he would be gruff. Back in his room, he would confide to his journal, "A virtue which I need in a higher degree is gentleness. If I had more of an air of gentleness, I should be much mended." At home in East Windsor, he had been accustomed to coddling from women, for he was an only son with 10 sisters. The girls were all so tall that Timothy Edwards, their father, referred jocularly to his 60 feet of daughters. Timothy, a graduate of Harvard and the son of a prosperous merchant, had come to Connecticut in 1694. His wife was the daughter of Solomon Stoddard, the most powerful figure in the Connecticut River Valley. The Indians found Stoddard so imposing that they called him the white man's god, though he was, as a matter of fact, merely a clergyman. Esther Stoddard Edwards was a strong personality herself. She was highly intelligent and so robust that when she reached her 90s, she was still holding afternoon salons for the discussion of books. The forceful mother and 10 sisters had accustomed Edwards to the admiring attention of women. Sarah was something strange for him to absorb. Edwards had achieved a degree of self-confidence during the successful period he had just spent in New York City, serving a small Presbyterian church in a cluster of Dutch-style houses around a breezy harbor. He worked competently there and made friends whom he kept for life. After that year, he wavered between an offer from a parish in Bolton, Connecticut, and the option of returning to Yale for his advanced degree. By choosing New Haven, he stepped into a chaotic situation. In 1722, Timothy Cutler, rector, president of the college, had showed a leaning toward Episcopalianism. This seemed a shocking aberration to Puritans whose parents had left their home country to escape the domination of the Church of England. A stormy scene between Cutler and the trustees ended with the dismissal of the rector and 3 tutors who supported him. Cutler went to England and confirmed the apprehension of the trustees by actually changing over to become an Episcopalian. Edwards was rocked. He had considered Cutler both a friend and sponsor. When the rector first met Jonathan in 1719, he had written to Timothy Edwards, "I congratulate you upon his promising abilities and advances in learning. He is now under my care and probably may continue so." The Cutler affair demoralized Yale as well as Edwards. In the year that followed, almost the whole responsibility for holding the college together crashed down on 3 remaining tutors. Even under easy circumstances, a tutor had a rigorous role. He had not only to maintain order among the rambunctious students in the dormitories, but to drill them in their lessons and organize the debates that were held 2 a week in the dining hall. A tutor was in a tricky role as a disciplinarian, for he was paid only a pittance and counted on gifts from students to supplement his income. Students everywhere were feeling frisky in that period after the first years of austerity in Puritan society. Bundling and dancing were common, and even ordinations were alcoholic events. There is recorded in the Acts and Judgments of the President and Tutors at Yale College the story of one evening during which undergraduates stamped and jumped until they broke the plaster, and when the tutors sent for them, they behaved with the utmost insolence, contempt, and disrespect. To rein in such jovial commotion was hard employment for a man like Edwards, but he reminded himself to keep a benign aspect and air of acting and speaking in all places and in all companies, except it should so happen that duty requires otherwise. Edwards wrote this in the journal he intermittently kept from December 1722 until June 1726, the years of his courtship. It gives us a picture of the miseries of a genius in love. He intended the diary to be destroyed at his death, but it was not with him when he died. To keep the record private, he wrote delicate passages in a shorthand he had invented. His handwriting discourages the snooper, for it was a tiny scrawl, aggravated by his habit of saving paper by writing up and down across lines. His handwriting shows the strain he was undergoing. In the first pages, it was small but neat. By 1725, his most agitated year, it became spiky and taut, and the entries went like these. December 29, dull and lifeless. January 9, decayed. January 10, recovering. Lonely on the social periphery, pressured in his job, insecure in his courtship, Edwards had sunk into the period of floundering that often characterizes the spiritual pilgrimage of an unusual man. At the same time in England, ugly, depressed, Samuel Johnson had dropped out of Oxford. There is a long list of young men who threshed about uncomfortably before they were able to come to terms with the extraordinary personalities they had been given. The consciousness of sin that weighed on every serious Puritan was exacerbated in Edwards by his powerful emotions about Sarah. He once sternly instructed himself to think of a safe subject, such as arithmetic. "When I am violently beset with temptation, or cannot rid myself of evil thoughts, to do some sum in arithmetic or geometry or some other study which necessarily engages all my thoughts and unavoidably keeps them from wandering." The Yale trustees had noted how hard Edwards was working to help hold the college together, and at the commencement in 1725, he got a raise. The tutors, for their extraordinary services of the year past, and their trouble and pains in sorting the books and fixing catalogues to ye boxes, have £5 each added to their salary. A subsequent history of Yale acknowledged the Honorable William Smith, the Honorable Daniel Edwards, an uncle of Jonathan's, and the Reverend President Edwards were the pillar tutors and the glory of the college at the critical period. Almost the entire government and instruction of the college fell upon these men. Then physical illness provided Edwards with the complete change of pace he needed. When he started riding home after the commencement, he was feeling dreadful. Each mile he felt worse, and he made it only as far as North Haven, where he collapsed with pleurisy at the house of his friend, Isaac Stiles, who had just moved there with his bride. He was ill so long that his mother came down to nurse him. The Stiles and Edwards families intertwined for several generations. Isaac Stiles had been a weaver in East Windsor when Timothy Edwards persuaded him to get an education, so he went to Yale when he was 20 years old. As a result of this decision to switch careers, Isaac's family produced a president of Yale from 1777 to 1795 in Ezra Stiles. Timothy Edwards worried about the bother his sick son had caused the newlywed Isaac Stiles and wrote his own wife, "Forget not to thank Mr. Stiles and mistress for any kindness they have showed you." And then he added an admonition typical of a fussy father, "Put Jonathan in mind to pay Mr. Stiles." From this low point, Edwards mended. The desperate interval had been for him like the experience a beginner has in learning to make pottery. He fights the clay, pushing with all his strength against the whirling bob on the wheel, but it seems to have a wicked will of its own, resisting the hand of the clumsy potter. Then comes the moment when the clay is mysteriously centered. It touches the spot where it should be and settles, peaceful and pliant. At last, the process of shaping can begin. Edwards finally knew what kind of man he had to be, and from then on he was integrated, the parts of him staying together under stress. He had centered down. His diary after his return to New Haven for the new school year shows signs of vitality surging back. He wins the affection of the reader with this comment: "It is better that the prayer be of almost any shortness than that my mind should be almost continually off what I say." He began to try harder in the social graces and reminded himself, "One thing wherein I have erred, as I would be complete in all social duties, is in neglecting to write letters to friends." He was less prickly, so the courtship began to run more smoothly. Both Edwards and Sarah enjoyed tramping on beaches and through woods. Sarah discovered that the young man, who had at first appeared pallidly bookish, was an observant naturalist and a stimulating guide to nature. At the age of 12, he had written an essay on the habits of insects and another remarkable study about rainbows. He records this healthy, entirely human response to one day of wonderful weather: "Sometimes on fair days, I find myself more particularly disposed to regard the glories of the world than to betake myself to the study of serious religion." Sarah shared Edwards' sensitivity to the beauty of their surroundings. In those days, New Haven, which was contained between two high rock formations and faced the endless variety of the sea, was a fortunate setting for two confirmed walkers. When winter turned life inward, their beauty surrounded them, too. New Englanders had learned early how to wrap coziness around them against the outdoor chill. In the handsome Pierpont house, fireplaces in each room not only held off cold, but provided glowing centers of light that glinted on brightly polished brass andirons and cherry wood tables. Snug inside when November sleet fell, Jonathan and Sarah discovered that they could talk comfortably about books together. Sarah introduced Edwards to her own copy of a book by Peter Maastricht, which was to influence Edwards's thought about the nature of the covenant. Edwards's enthusiasm about the Yale Library made Sarah's father purr, for that was a project close to the heart of James Pierpont. Soon after Pierpont had supervised the transfer of some church land for the first college building, he gathered 10 clergymen around a table in a neighboring parsonage. Pierpont put 6 of his own books on the table and said, "I give these books for the founding of a college in this colony." The other men added some books from their own shelves, and 41 books collected that day started the Yale Library.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle is adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.